It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The floodwaters have once again receded in Iowa, and who do we turn to for advice when it's time to clean up? Bill McAnally, of course, our home improvement expert, is on the line with us today. Hello, Bill.
Hey, good morning, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today. And, of course, throughout the hour, we're going to be taking your calls. So if you are drying out after the floods of this year, give us a call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, Bill, if you're in a municipality as the floodwaters receded, if your home was flooded, there are local officials who are going to come around and check things out and make sure that it's safe for you to go back into the house. But what happens once you get back into the house?
Well, that's always the tough part is, you know, what do we do first? Well, you know, hopefully the officials that go around, you know, are making sure that, you know, you don't have any immediate safety issues like, you know, your power is on still or a case that if your power is on, you know, there might be a chance of electrocution. There's all, you know, you hear about that like every year someone, you know, has that type of an accident. But, you know, when we go into these houses, especially, you know, like the last time it happened, you know, in Cedar Rapids or on the Missouri River, a lot of people just don't think about, you know, just that simple things of the type of water that comes down the river. You know, it's just it's nasty, unhealthy, slimy stuff that comes down that river. People are walking in it, and if they're able to get into their house, you know, everything is pretty much covered wherever that water table was, and then above it, you know, with types of materials that like to suck water, you know, are contaminated. But along with that, it you know, you look a concrete floor or a tile floor, linoleum floor, things like that, they can be extremely slippery. And, you know, we always like to talk about mold and all these things, but there's these other safety issues when people go in there that you know, you need to look up for. Everything is slippery, it's dirty. The last thing you want to do is step on any, you know, like a nail or a wire, something that punctures your, you know, your boots. One of my daughters actually stepped on something. They were on a canoe trip this summer in the Des Moines River, I think it was, and she stepped on something, went through her shoe. And, I mean, it just became infected so fast. I mean, she was on heavy medication for quite a while for infection, and that was during when the water was low and, you know, had a lot lower level of contaminants. So, you know, all those things, and you know, you shouldn't be even going in that house unless, you know, you're wearing protective gear, you know, like rubber boots, non-latex type gloves, an N95 mask. That's probably one of the most important things, is the right type of respirator. When we see people walk in and they feel like they're protected with these little dust masks, you know, that you can buy 10 of them for like $5, they're not doing you much good at all. I mean, you need a respirator that's rated for, it's an N95 rating type mask. And you need eye protection as well, because when you get into these houses and, you know, if it's been 24 to 48 hours, you know, you already have mold. There's, you know, one of the biggest wastes of money is a mold test. You know, when you even check with Iowa Department of Public, you know, Health or EPA or the CDC, you know, they're all right. They're saying, you know, you have mold, and a mold test really isn't going to do you any good at all.
All right, so we get back into the house, and we're wearing our protection, and we want to get things dried out. Now, a lot of people, especially in this flood event, we had a lot of people who had their basements totally full of water. Of course, some people up onto the first floor, but a lot of wet basements, which is
right.
the constant problem that people deal with. So once the water has receded, what do you have to do to try to dry things out and also get rid of that mold?
Well, you need to open everything up. I mean, that's probably the best slide that I've ever, best picture that I turned into a slide, was in Cedar Rapids after the large flood there. Is a home that was just completely stripped down to bare studs. I mean, you could see the whole structure of the house. They took off all of the sheeting on the outside of the house, the drywall, the insulation, because this one had water that went up to about the window level in the house. And, you know, that's horrible. I mean, that you have to go that way. But in many cases, you know, people will open up their walls completely to the outside for the first 2 or 3 feet. So this, you know, normally this time of year, the air is a little bit drier and a little breezy. And so air that house out. And if you can't do that, you know, you need to get everything out of there that's wet. And that's carpet. You know, that's hopefully, you know, people don't have a whole lot of carpet in their basement. There's, you know, this is a good reason why we don't really like carpet in basements. Anything, though, that's wet has to get outside. And, you know, like rugs and things. And if it's porous like that, you know, in some cases you may have to throw it away. Some things, you know, you can have cleaned. The Smithsonian has a site on if, you know, like say something that's very valuable on how to prepare it for cleaning or preservation after, you know, a wetting or a mold instance. But you do, like the drywall, you know, that's on your walls, you know, you need to cut that up at least, you know, a couple feet usually above where the highest water mark was. Because, like I said, at 24 to 48 hours, it's growing, whether you see it or not. And if water gets inside these walls, it'll just keep climbing up the backside of your drywall. It'll climb up the studs, the framework that's on the inside. And, you know, if it stays wet, it's going to keep growing. So that's why we have to dry it. So it has to be very well ventilated. You know, we're talking fans and you know, very good commercial dehumidification systems. You know, professionals come in and they just dry these houses down. But a lot of times what we forget, though, too, is, you know, people will think, okay, let's turn on that furnace. And a lot of times that's shot, but they'll use that ductwork for ventilation. And in many cases, it depends on the house, but in many cases, that's really what you don't want to do, because then it pulls a lot of those spores inside that ductwork, which is very hard to clean. And then it can spread it out through parts of the house that that may not have the spores actively growing yet.
All right. So the main message that I'm hearing from you is that we really cannot depend on what has gotten wet to dry on its own.
No, it's not going to. You have to get a lot of air moving. And I met a professional from Minnesota a few years ago, and what he did was, you know, he said people will bring fans in their house and they just kind of aim them. And he says what you need is circulation. So you set the fans up so they're moving like a circle, basically. So the air is rotating and moving instead of like aiming it into the corner or aiming it at a special, you know, a certain spot. You know, that you keep that air so things dry, but it's not going to dry unless you get that humidity down, you know, to 40% or so inside the house, or you use a commercial type of dehumidifiers. And the downside is so many people are affected that they're hard to find to rent. And, you know, the big professional mold remediation people, you know, the good ones have this equipment. Some of them have it to rent out. But, yes, you've got to have a lot of air. And most of the time people don't want to tear their house apart that far to do it correctly. You know, they just want to open up a little bit of an area. And that's not going to do it. And in many cases, and especially if people are you know, have respiratory issues or other types of immune system, you know, weakening issues, you know, they're very susceptible. Many of them are very susceptible to what's in the air. You know, you just touch something when you're walking through a house. You know, you might pick up, oh, my gosh, look at this picture that I have, and I've lost it. You may have disturbed enough that if you don't have the correct mask on that you can ingest or inhale something that can cause you issues. You know, the Center on Disease Controls, when you look at a lot of their technical stuff, it just scares the heck out of you of what can happen with just, you know, a very, very small amount of, like, say, mold spores getting into your system.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert, is here today. We've been talking about what to do after the floodwaters recede, and if you have questions for Bill about your wet basement or any of your home improvement projects, give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. And yes, we've been talking about flood recovery and wet basements, but you are welcome to join our conversation with any questions you have about your home improvement projects. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And the phone lines are open for your questions right now. And we've got Tom on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Tom.
Hey, hi, Charity.
What's your question?
Some time ago, the last few months, Bill was talking about heat pumps as a alternative to propane heat, stuff like that in outbuildings or in converting an old farmhouse kind of thing. And I'm going to build an outbuilding, but I'm having trouble finding what I consider real information about heat pumps, how they work. And Bill said something about efficiency ratings being 200%, and I don't get that. I thought 100% was maximum, but can you talk just for a minute about that?
Yeah, it, you know, what it relates to, what I would do is probably one of the best sites is, you know, go to your utility company website, and I don't know if you're on a cooperative or Alliant in that area or Mid-American, but they explain, like, the differences between energy efficiency rating, all these coefficient things, and you know, when I first was involved with geothermal long time ago, I was exactly the same thing. I said, okay, you know, this sounds like magic, you know, but what it does is when like, especially for a geothermal system, when they're using the energy from the ground, you know, what it does is it produces heat or cooling, but it uses compressor systems. So when you take a certain amount of energy, it will give you, like, say, 200. Some of them are now up to 300% of useful heating and cooling from the amount that you put in. And until you actually, you know, see the diagram and everything, it's, a lot of times it's kind of hard to explain, but it basically uses the two differences in temperature and in the compressor system and types of fluids that you put through the ground, and like an antifreeze, like a glycol system that takes the temperature from the ground. So you're using, like, let's say it's like 10 degrees outside, you know, you're using roughly 50 degree soil to, you know, pull temperature in, to pull heat out of during the winter. But some of the other things that are really going strong right now is mini splits, and like, say, for a small outbuilding, a real open design, you may want to look at something like that as a mini split system. They're good down to about, you know, some systems are good down to about 10 below. We're having a hard time getting the really cold ones, cold climate ones from that are good down to about 35 below. Right now we can only get them from Canada. They're hard to get, but the technology is going very fast. They heat and cool. And they're just a wall mount type system with a compressor outside. But yeah, call your utility company, and they will give you about as much information as you want. And the Iowa Geothermal Heat Pump Association has some things, but you can go to Building Science Corporation, and that one explains heat pumps and all the different types of heat pumps. We have air source heat pumps, water source heat pumps. They're all a little bit different. But also the Department of Energy has some really good sites and really good diagrams. And until you really see the diagram, you know, it's kind of hard to explain on the phone, but until you really see the diagram, it's hard to understand how that actually works. Because to me it sounds like it's a source of infinite energy, you know, the first time that I heard that as well, you know. But yeah, go to those sources, and when you see it on a diagram, it really helps out a lot.
Okay, you said mini split.
Yeah, mini splits. I actually have one of those. It's you know, you see them in a lot of TV shows or movies when you look for them. The non-ducted ones are kind of like a console, about 3 feet long, maybe a foot tall. They stick out about 8 or 10 inches from the wall. They're usually white-colored, mounted up near the ceiling on a wall. And they'll give you heating and cooling in a, you know, depending how open your area is, for 1,000 to 1,500 square foot. And then when they go in tandem, like some compressors that sit outside can feed up to 8 of those units. So, I mean, you could easily do homes, and they're really big on in remodeling when you can't get ductwork throughout a house. So you'll see them on a lot of commercial buildings when their heating and cooling systems can't keep up with their needs. Then you'll see these compressors sitting out of outside of a building. And, you know, they use those as additional heating and cooling sources.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions about any home improvement projects or things you're considering. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. We've got room for a couple of calls right now. You can tweet.
Sunshine. I'm sorry to bother
you. Yeah.
You know, I think every mold cleanup kit has a bottle of bottled sunshine in there that Charity, that
oh,
really sounded nice.
Bill, I knew you couldn't resist.
No,
all right, I'm going to say that.
Mine sounded like flood-ravaged horse manure, and I didn't really appreciate that. Yours was bottled sunshine, and that wasn't very nice. I didn't think that you said that about me, but that's okay, I guess.
All right, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I mean, Bill, before we entirely move on from the mini splits and some of the interesting alternatives that we're finally getting for heating and cooling options, and I realize that these are options that have been available in other countries for quite some time, how do the mini splits do as far as energy efficiency go?
They're very energy efficient. They're right up. They're getting very close to geothermal, and in some cases, especially on the cooling side, that's where they're very efficient. The nice thing is when you find somebody that's used to installing them, because I don't know why the United States is always seems to be, we're a little bit behind, but commercial contractors have been using them for years. I mean, but the residential market is just kind of, you know, wading into it now. You know, it's the thing is their efficiencies are so good, and they're getting so much better, so much faster that, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, down the road here, that may be, you know, maybe getting into the, like, say, 30 to 40% of the market. I mean, that's very optimistic, I think. But you know, the nice thing is they're a small unit. They're highly, highly efficient. You don't have, you know, they're all electric. I'm not, proposing anything or pushing anything, but they're all electric, and so you don't worry about carbon monoxide, things like that. And they're highly adaptable, and they come in a variation of sizes. I mean, They're really a nice system, and they're so doggone quiet. Because I was in a person's office the other day, and we were talking about him, and his computer was going. And I said, you know what? The mini split I have is quieter than your computer sitting over there humming. And you know, I have to always get up, and maybe it's because I got bad hearing, but I always have to get up and look and make sure that the thing is running. I mean, they're just so nice. A tremendous amount of controls. You know, you can heat, cool, quick to set the temperatures, all in a handheld thermostat. And there's just a lot of different options.
And are they becoming more widely available? Because looking around just a couple of years ago, it was hard to find a contractor who worked with them.
Yeah, you know, it is. And it's really funny. You know, they're more for, like, say, our climate a little bit south, because the technologies, you know, we're down to that 10 to 15 below. But a few years ago, they weren't any good till down, you know, even below, like, 10 or 15 above. But it's really funny. Every time I go up to Minnesota, even in northern Minnesota, all they talk about is guys putting in mini splits, because some of the rebates and tax advantages of geothermal are disappearing in January. So that, you know, that right there was kind of a big draw in for geothermal. I mean, I've got geothermal in my house. I love it, but you know, down the road, what are we going to use? And that's what's neat, is we're finding so many different options. Well, and one reason is, too, our houses, you know, are becoming, you know, hopefully most of them, the new ones, are becoming more efficient. And, you know, and there's a strong drive to take Iowa's, you know, aging homes and you know, doing energy efficient retrofits. We're trying to do that with the Economic Development Authority now to bring those homes up so that they're healthier, more comfortable, and more energy efficient. And then you don't need these huge systems that we had in the past. You know, you once you've captured the heat energy and you keep it inside the house and it's not leaking, well, you know, obviously you don't need as large a system. So, you know, this whole heating and cooling and comfort and healthy home is really changing here in the last 5 to 10 years. Hopefully it'll keep going. But yeah, the equipment, some of this equipment that we've been seeing coming, especially like say from Germany, Scandinavian, Canada, just it's amazing what it's doing.
Well, let's get back to the phones. Jim is on the line in Ames. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I've been dealing with leaks coming in around the windows in a newly remodeled old brick building. And one of the possibilities that we've been told about is that it's the old brick that is allowing the moisture in a driving rain,
mm-hmm.
and that we need to put some sort of treatment on it. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, a lot of times on old brick, especially if you put, there's some treatments on there that are going to actually cause it to fail faster, because the old style brick, you know, what you have to do is you need to get a hold of a mason that's been around for years and years and years, and then the Masonry Institute, you can Google I can't remember if it's the American Masonry Institute, just Google Masonry Institute. And what a lot of commercial contractors and architects, what they'll do is they'll get a sample of that brick, and then they test it and see if a certain type of sealer is going to degrade the brick, and it's the way the type of mortar, because we've used so many different types of mortar, if it's going to cause issues, because that whole house is a system. And sometimes when we stick a sealer on the outside, what it does is it prevents moisture from evaporating, especially in an older home. It'll come through the house and then get in the brick, and it can't get out, and then it causes it to freeze, and then it blows the brick facing off. So that's sometimes a real scary thing. So you want to get with get a hold of the Masonry Institute and find out, you know, exactly if that, and especially in our climate, is going to, you know, be a detriment to your system. The other thing is, it doesn't matter if it's new brick, old brick, moisture, you know, even just a mist on brick, when the sun comes out, especially on the west and south, it just through vapor push is what it is. Is it pushes that moisture through the brick, and then it condenses on the backside and then runs down between the brick and the house. And when you put replacement windows or even new windows, a lot of times in brick buildings, if they aren't installed right, that water will get in and leak around your windows. It's very hard for many people to put a replacement window into an old brick building, because there's, you know, how are you going to get your fingers in there, especially, you know, to flash around the windows, so when the water does get behind the brick, and it will, I mean, it's just always happens, it's going to get behind there and leak around your windows. So it's the flashing issue around the window a lot of times that where the water's coming from. But I would not put a sealer on that until I had someone that, you know, sometimes it's even an engineer that says this type of sealer is still going to allow, you know, the moisture to come through and evaporate and not ruin the brick and mortar contact system. So sometimes it's a semi-permeable, sometimes it's a permeable, but you know, I wouldn't do that until I, you know, had that looked at by a real professional. Those are really scary.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of brick houses where the face of the brick will blow off because the moisture gets trapped.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for your call. And we've got another caller on the line, and we probably won't get through the entire question before our break here. But Karen in Guttenberg, can you give Bill your question? And then if we don't get time to answer it, we can finish up answering when we get back.
Sure. We have a mid-century modern home in Guttenberg, pardon me, over the river. So we have the Mississippi Flyway, lots of birds. It's redwood. And has the deep overhangs of a mid-century modern. the woodpeckers have great fun with that overhang, and they create all kinds of holes in the overhang.
Right.
And then, of course, the bats then get in.
Okay.
So we've had the bat experts come in, and we can get rid of the bats, but then the woodpeckers come back, create more holes, and then we have more bats.
All right. So
my question is, how do we take care of the woodpeckers?
Okay.
All right. Well, Bill's not an expert on wildlife, but we will talk about those holes in just a moment when we get back in a moment. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, on the show with me today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is on the air with me today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. We've got phone lines open for you right now at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, we had Karen on the line in Guttenberg. She's got holes in her redwood siding created by woodpeckers as part of this never-ending cycle of holes. So do you have any advice for her, Bill?
Yeah, normally the reason, especially in her case, the reason that the woodpeckers are tapping on the house is they're going for insects, especially, you know, on these the houses that have larger overhangs. A lot of times there's less sun that gets to the wood, and you know, redwood has a tendency to hold a little bit more moisture sometimes just because of, you know, it's mechanics. But if you can eliminate those bugs, so normally what the best thing to do is to, you know, have a pest control person come over and treat the wood, and then you can fill the holes with, I like wood epoxies, and something that you can stain or paint to match what you have there. But most of the, you know, the majority of the time, it's just because there's bugs back there, they can hear it, and then they'll tap into it, and they're just feeding. You know, in some cases, people will put, you know, a feeder out, and then it kind of said, well, we'll go to the feeder instead of, you know, wrapping our head on this house. The feeder's easier. Sometimes they'll do that, but it's usually because there's bugs back there and because it is moist. And so I would just have a, you know, pest control person come by, take a look at it, and that should eliminate the issue.
All right. And so when redwood siding is so very beautiful, but it does often have some problems. Is it something you recommend these days or not?
Well, you know, not so much now because we can't get the old growth redwood like we used to. It's just like cedar. You know, the cedar trees that they harvest now are not the old growth type of woods, and so they don't have, you know, that decay resistance that the old cedar and the old redwood did. And that's why I really hate to see it when people tear off old redwood siding because, you know, the paint's coming off of it or something, and it has nothing to do with the siding. It's moisture issues usually from inside the house. When you can take those boards and run them through a planer and take off just take the paint or the stain off, and you're back to beautiful redwood siding, especially if it's, you know, like a shiplap or a tongue and groove type siding. And I've done that before. I mean, I just love the color red one. It's, like I say, it's a resource that you can still get, but it's not the same as what it was. So you hate to see somebody throw away the old redwood because you're not going to get that back.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, and you can be the next to call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have this question. It's a follow-up to the conversation we had about mini splits. My husband and I wanted to install a mini split unit for heating and cooling in our upstairs bedroom, but the cost of installation was too high, $4,000 to $5,000, although the unit itself wasn't as expensive, around $1,000. Why is the installation fee so high, and can we find someone to install it more inexpensively?
You know, that just amazes me, too, why the installation is so high, because there isn't that much labor in those, and I'll probably get chewed on about this, but they're very simple to put in, and it depends on, of course, what they had to run through in that particular house. I don't know how the house was built or anything like that, but in many cases they're very easy to put in. You know, they even sell do-it-yourself ones. I'm not pushing those or anything, but the one that I bought was I think I paid like $1,500 for it, and we put it in about an hour. I helped a friend put one in, and the only reason it took more than an hour and a half is because I wasn't paying attention where some of the lines were going. And I'm not going to get into it, but I goofed up. But anyway, it works. It works perfect. And so I don't know, and I think a lot of times it's just because of it's a little bit different. And, you know, they don't want to some contractors don't want to put them in. And, of course, you know, sometimes it's whatever the market will bear. So, you know, I would check around for different contractors. You know, I know that most of them up north are running around, you know, $3,000 for a single one, you know, installed. But that, like I say, it all depends on the house, and it depends on, you know, travel time and all
kinds of things. So as they become more common, they'll probably also become less expensive to have installed.
Yeah, they've dropped down in price. Of course, you know, you can buy the super high quality ones, or the ones that, you know, you're paying for sometimes the name. You know, they'll be more expensive, but you know, there's some that are just really good. They've been around a long time and they're very dependable.
All right.
But yeah, that, you know, I would get a few more estimates.
All right. Let's go to Silas on the line in Ames. Hi, Silas.
Uh-oh.
Hello.
No, one person named Silas. So go ahead, Smarty Pants. Let's hear it.
my question is regarding floodwaters in our basement. It's not a regular thing, but there is enough water that we figure we should do something about it. And the problem is we don't know where the water is coming in from. We see the water on the floor, but we can't find a place where the water is coming in at. So how do we go about finding that water so then we can figure out what our solution needs to be to fix the leak?
Okay, well, you're a different Silas. The other Silas is a big dumb guy. So you're not obviously him. do you have a sump pump?
Yeah,
we do. In your basement?
Yep.
How much water is in the sump pump?
That's a good question. It runs constantly when we had this last rain in Ames. It was running constantly for about 7 days.
Okay. You know what I'd do first is I would get a bigger sump pump. If it's a sump pump came with the house, it's probably pretty small. What I've installed, because I can get a lot of water at one time in my location, I installed basically a sewage pump. They're about $350. That one will pump water like, I mean, you know, something you want to fill up swimming pools with.
Oh wow!
I would go to that one. I would try that first, and then pull the power on your when you're down there working on it. When it's unplugged, reach down in the sump pit and see how many holes are coming into the pit, not just the tile that comes into it, but there may be holes that drain water, like, say, the size of a pencil, draining in. And if that's the case, reach down and whatever will fit through those holes, start poking those holes to get all the fine sediment so you can get more water in there so you can get it out of there faster. You can, in some cases, when the water's down all the way, you know, take a cordless drill and drill some more holes and whatever's there to let more water in, because we want to get it out as fast as possible. And in your case, it may just be so much hydraulic pressure underneath your home. You know, we don't know what's underneath your slab that's pushing it up. So it may be coming up between, that small seam between the floor and the wall.
Yeah.
Do you think that may be where it's coming from, that pressure, you know, around the perimeter?
That's a good possibility, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I wish there was a way that you could be there right when it starts, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have any cracks? Do you have, well, you probably do, but, I mean, do you have cracks in your floor that where it's coming up as well, you think? Or?
Yeah, that's the thing. We don't see, it's a 1930s house.
Yeah.
And cinder block walls in the basement, which was, I think, pretty new technology for the 30s, but
yeah.
It was, those are original to the house, and so it's only on one side of the basement, and not seeing a lot of cracks that are big or noticeable in the floor or in the wall.
Okay.
So it's just a little bit of a mystery, but that sump pump might be the option to check out next.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if that's like the original one, they're usually pretty small pit, And sometimes they're only like, say, 16 or maybe even 12 inches wide, just barely enough to get a pump down in there. So you may have to upgrade, you know, cut around that pit and put a bigger pit in, fill around it with clean, you know, P-rock or a clean limestone, fill around that and put a whole new system in that it could evacuate a lot of water. And that may cure it because, you know, back then they just, whatever the ground was, they poured the concrete on it. They didn't do waterproofing or anything like
right.
that. So you just got a lot of hydraulic pressure that you need to relieve. But also look outside and try to get the water sloping away from your house, you know, like have about 6 inches of fall in the first 10 feet if possible. And then also see if you by chance have a, you know, it's kind of late, but a late model home, but you may have a cistern that sits outside that collects rainwater. Some areas still have those out in the yard. And maybe it has a lid, and if it has a lid on it, you know, you can get in it and fill that thing in, because what happens is the water goes into this pit and then it drains, comes right back to your house again, and you just keep, you know, pumping it over and over and over.
All right. Well, Silas, good luck with that. We'll slip in a question here from Susan in Cedar Rapids. Our house, built in 1991, came with a sunroom that we converted to a dining room in 1998. The sunroom was built with 2x6 walls and is on supports and open beneath with about 2 feet between the room and the ground. When we did the conversion, we had the heat duct extended into the far wall of the room and insulated with bat insulation, but the floor is still cold. Unfortunately, we did not install in-floor heating at the time we put in the wood floor. What would you suggest for options now? Would it be difficult to remove the bat insulation and replace it with spray foam insulation, to given the limited workspace beneath the room?
You know, I would remove that, and what really works good is, you know, I'd get underneath, pull the sheeting or whatever that's on underneath it out, and replace it with either bats or spray foam, you know, get a price on both. But you've got to fill the cavity completely. That, you know, so if it's a 2x10 floor joist, you've got about 9 1/4 inches of space. You have to fill that thing completely with insulation. And even with spray foam, you can't just put a skim coat on it. It has to be full. And then put 1 inch of foam on underneath that, like a sheet of foam, extruded foam. Put that underneath, and then put plywood underneath that, caulk all the seams, and paint that so that it's a good airtight structure, and that should take care of it. But you've got to fill the cavity and seal it very well.
All right. Susan, thank you for your question. And Bill McAnally, thank you so much.
Well, yeah, I'm going to have to give the other Silas a call now, so he's probably expecting it.
All right, Bill, we'll talk to you in November, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.